All right. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. It means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And you know... Dave is gone.
Okay.
But Sandy, I will say this to you. You know, I love having these conversations and dialogue with you because, you know, I don't know why we don't think in this country that this is important stuff to talk about. And you know, so what are we going to do? Wait for a time where all of this is going to hit us squarely in the face and we're not prepared. We haven't thought about, I mean, the American people. I don't mean, clearly the military brass, Sandy, and you know, the Pentagon and all of them, they're talking about this constantly.
Yeah, but they come at it with a bias.
A hammer.
Well, the hammer, yeah. They got a hammer and everything's a nail, right?
Right.
And, you know, I think the problem, and I mentioned this several months ago on the radio, I think the real issue is how does America decide who our enemies are and why do we decide that? You know, China was clearly not our enemy 20 years ago when the government was definitely condoning much of American business transferring a great deal of its production capacity to China. And when Apple and everyone else began to employ China to be a place where a great deal of our electronics stuff was assembled, using their educated and very capable workforce to our benefit. And what has made them our enemy now? Well, quite frankly, I think if we were honest with ourselves, it's because they've converted all that knowledge into an economic powerhouse, and they've become an economic powerhouse that rivals our economy. And so are they a military threat to us? No, they're an economic threat to us. And of course, all of that economic might they have facilitates their capacity to build something like a navy that is comparable to ours. They have a huge, they're hugely reliant on the Pacific. They're hugely reliant on trade over the oceans for a great deal of their economy. They're as interested in the waterways as the United States is. And that's what navies are premised on,
right?
Interest in the waterway. And so, why did we decide they are our enemy? And how did we decide Russia was? And we can see what happened once we did decide that. The path of the two countries took a different path, and we've ended up in Ukraine. And we can blame it on Russia, but it probably has as much to do with how we were dealing with Russia beginning in 2008 as it does with Russia. And now we've got China, and China's a huge problem. And we're doing it over Taiwan, which is even more closely, you know, the hegemony of China over Taiwan is much more clearly cut because we agreed to it by treaty in 1979. Congress passed it.
So, Sandy, I'm just a lowly talk show host, and I ask this question. We have ships over in the area of where China is, plenty of them.
We've got a Pacific fleet and an Atlantic fleet.
Where are the Chinese ships near us?
Right. In fact, the United States got very stirred up about the notion that China might open a base on the Atlantic.
I know.
Just to be on our ocean. The Atlantic Ocean, where they only belong on the Pacific Ocean, it was an interesting, I thought, outlook in terms of the view of the right of a nation like China to have military bases abroad. We have them all over the world.
But that says it all, right? I mean, that says it all. And if we can't get the American people to really, you know, Dave said we're headed towards World War III. I don't quite think we're headed there, but we're not.
Well, let's put it this way. When two cars are driving at one another, both cars can avert the collision if they choose to.
Right.
If they see it coming, both cars can avert the collision. And the question is whether we're going to take the steps necessary to avert the collision.
Well, see, and I think the only way we can do that, Sandy, is the more the American people are aware of what it is that is happening, and we have these conversations openly, and then we challenge our government on it, because the people who will suffer are the American people if any of those types of things happen. And our way of life that we tout is certainly going to change if we wind up in some kind of skirmish. And our nation has a history of being involved.
Well, skirmish is the wrong word to use for what we would be involved with. And I fear the American public doesn't understand that. We've flexed our muscle around the world. We've had Afghanistan. We've had Iraq. We've had these various circumstances, even Vietnam, which was a horrific, didn't really come home to roost in America in a serious sort of a way. Certainly Afghanistan and Iraq did not. It didn't affect life in America much at all. It affected some service people and how they experienced life upon their return, and that was devastating. But so we're not talking about that when we talk about Taiwan and China. We're talking about something much bigger than that. We can see that with respect to what's going on in Ukraine, and we should reflect on how did Ukraine happen and why.
Right.
And then we should. And some people would say, well, we should have been tougher, and Ukraine wouldn't have happened. I think it was our toughness that caused Ukraine to happen. It was our sword rattling that caused it to happen.
Well, Sandy,
and now we're sword rattling in China, and we're sword rattling over Taiwan, which China believes pretty righteously is with not only within their hegemony but within their country.
You know, Sandy, you clearly don't know what you're talking about. This next guy on the line is going to prove that what's happening in Ukraine is because of Joe Biden. CJ?
Yeah, thank you, Earl, and thank you, Sandy. I'll tell you that before you disagree with me, but certainly. Yeah, you guys.
You know, it's you disagreeing with him. Today. By the way, it's you disagreeing with him. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for clarifying. You know,
yeah, I have to.
I heard Sandy blame Russia for the invasion of Ukraine, and yes, but that started with Crimea, and that was when the Red Line and President Obama did nothing in Syria, and that's when Putin moved on Crimea. And the same reason when the disaster, the surrendering of Afghanistan by Commander Cut and Run Biden, Trump had a conditional withdrawal. He listened to his military advisors and he didn't go to zero. You know, Biden changed every policy, but he blames it on Trump.
CJ, let me ask you before you go any further, I'll let you continue. Have you listened to any of the conversations Sandy and I have had?
Yes.
And so you ignore all of that and go back to what it is you're saying.
Yep. Because I believe in
CJ, CJ, I thought this would probably come up. You didn't get to it yet, but pretty soon I expect you to say that Biden handed the Bagram Air Force Base off to China. So I want you to know that I've done a bunch of research to find out if there is any evidence whatsoever to support that. And what there is a Donald Trump tweet to that effect. And there is an unsubstantiated internet article to that effect. And there is absolutely no verifiable intelligence whatsoever that China has in any way had personnel or has otherwise achieved any sort of control over the Bagram Air Force Base. So, I think repeating things that have been tweeted once.
How about this
don't
one?
Don't get
then,
you
Sandy.
All the way to fact. Oh, wait a minute. We got you. We had a discussion going here, and so go ahead. Make your point.
Well, if you're going to listen to President Biden,
I didn't say anything about listening to President Biden. I just said I went out and did research. None of this came from the Biden administration whatsoever.
You claim that Donald Trump is giving misinformation. How about this one, that Al-Qaeda is no longer in Afghanistan? He just took out the number two guy that was living in Afghanistan, in Kabul, and what was he the number two man of? Al-Qaeda. So we now opened up Afghanistan and terrorists. It's a new birthing ground for terrorists. And so, yes, I do blame President Biden for his weakness in Afghanistan, and Putin saw it, and he made his move. He didn't make his move when Trump was there. He didn't make his move and take more land from Ukraine.
Well, what's your thought about Taiwan? What's your thought about Taiwan and China?
I love that Nancy Pelosi's got bigger balls than President Biden.
And does that mean that you
and
think...
Because,
that...
you know, well, I just wanted to say, I want accountability. I don't care if it's the Trump family that's crooked or the Biden family.
Oh, here we
but
go.
Your party, now we found out that, what did Facebook, I can't remember his name, but I should.
Zuckerberg.
Yep, Zuckerberg just came out and said, yeah, FBI came to us and said, bury the Biden story. The Hunter Biden story.
What does that have to do with what we're talking about, CJ?
Well, CJ, I guess what I was trying to do is get the American public to steer away from sort of the partisan review of who shot John within American domestic politics and try and get us to focus on what do we think of our foreign policy and what should it be? And is our current trajectory in foreign policy one that the American public ought to support? Whether you're a conservative or a liberal. You know, conservatives in this country back in the 20s and 30s were isolationists who were very concerned about the United States spreading its wings too far and getting involved in foreign warfare. And it sounds like you've bought into the notion of hawkishness that America has got worldwide hegemony and that, for instance, we ought to take a role in the Taiwanese situation that is contrary to a treaty that our Congress passed and signed in 1979. Is that what you think?
No, I think that our military has been weakened by this president, and I believe what Ronald Reagan believed, peace through strength,
okay,
and trust but verify.
Okay, well that isn't really that doesn't really get us anywhere in the conversation about Taiwan, but
gotta go to break. Gotta go to break. 844-967-2789. Gotta go to a break. Be right back. Welcome back to the Earl Ingram Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789. You can text us at that same number. It's Friday. That means Friday's with Sandy Williams. And Sandy, we're going to keep plugging away. Let's go to Tom from L.A. Tom, go ahead.
Well, Earl, you know what? CJ would be maybe a little bit believable if you could just maybe ask him next time, say, can you answer one thing, CJ, that the Democratic Party or the President Biden has done that's been right? Because, I mean, when he loses all credibility when he absolutely thinks that everything, and, I mean, you know, waking up in the morning is Joe Biden's fault. Waking up in the morning was Barack Obama's fault. I mean, it's like every single thing in his brain is, everything is wrong that the Democratic president did, but everything was right that Trump did. I mean, come on, CJ. Get a life, man. You need some help, man. All you do is just repeat talking points. You're like Sarah Palin, a word salad when it just comes out your mouth. I mean, it's kind of like Jake's little commercial there before you came back on the air. That's what these people are like. They are robots. They don't think for themselves. And I'm glad, Earl, that you give them a place where they can possibly be saved and think for themselves. It's just amazing to me.
Hey, Tom, thank you very much for the call. You know, Sandy, once again, we're not going to convince CJ.
Well, here's what I think CJ could think about, though. He should think about where it is that America ought to stick its nose. You know, where is America's business such that we ought to stick our nose into the business? And by sticking our nose into the business, does that mean militarily? That's fraught. The answer to that is fraught with a lot of issues. The world around us has decided to organize its governments in many different ways. Most of the Western European governments are organized in many ways like us, although in some ways not so much like us. The cultures there have, the governments provide free health care. We don't provide free health care. That's a pretty fundamental difference between us, actually. They provide education for free. We're finding out just now how different that is in terms of not having a lot of student debt to deal with, right, politically and sociologically. So, you know, but they're organized pretty much like us. But most of the rest of the world is organized not so very much like us. And should we be sticking our nose into everybody else's socio-political situations to make it reflect like us? And we tend to say that we're doing that in the places we stick our nose, but we choose very selectively where that might be. So we do that in Afghanistan. We do that in Iraq. But on the other hand, we have a very beneficial relationship with Saudi Arabia, which has a very troublesome record on human rights. We're now saying that we're doing this about China when we didn't care about that 20 years ago, but now we do because of their economic might. We're now caring much more about the Uyghur situation in China and individual rights there. And so my point is, we should only look at that issue, and I think if it really is affecting the security of Americans and in America. And if we're troubled by how another country orchestrates itself internally, we can at least reflect that by not dealing with them. So, instance, we would maybe not enter into a lot of trade pacts that were beneficial to them, like we have with Saudi Arabia. We might not export or sell them a lot of munitions and weaponry like we do to Saudi Arabia. But the fact is that we aren't using that as the basis for where we stick our nose. We say that we're sticking our nose all over the world to try and make sure that democracy prevails. But should we really be exercising all of our national treasure for that purpose in a world in which billions of people have decided to organize themselves socially and politically differently than us?
You know, Sandy, what bothers me about all of that is whatever we were, we should be evolving from. And so even though that's the way we've thought as Americans in our policies, why can't we evolve from that?
Right.
Why are we so stuck on that, and to the degree, Sandy, that we can't ever move from that? I think that's the problem with all of it. The people who created that belief are long since gone. Where is that written?
Well, I don't know. That belief has sort of evolved, and much of it has evolved since World War II, so it isn't like an ancient belief. You know, isolationism was a very big movement, like I said to CJ. It was a conservative movement in the United States right up until World War II, and it took a great deal for us to get into World War I. We did it in a modest sort of a way compared to the rest of the world. And World War II was presented to us by Japan, although in some respects we provoked that a bit by the blockade we created around Japan for its access to oil. So since then, we've sort of evolved this domestic political sense of our foreign relations in a way that has been sort of a revisionist explanation for why we do what we do in international affairs, which is not well explained by the notion that we're trying to present democracy to people, because we failed to do that every place we've gone.
You know,
Iraq is not a democratic place today. Afghanistan, not a democratic place today. And Vietnam is what it was going to be if we hadn't done what we did to it.
You know, Sandy, you talked about Iraq, and nobody ever talks about that. Ever. Ever.
Yeah.
You know, and another failure on our part. We've got to go to a break. Sandy, when we come back, I want to talk about, you know, the death college debt. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Early Game Show. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789. That's 844-967-2789. You can text us at the same number. Sandy, I wanted to talk now about Joe Biden and the decision that's being made to forgive the debt that's owed to this nation. Sandy, if you look at the amount of dollars that are owed for student loans, it's got to be in the trillions, right?
Well, yeah, I think it's $1.7 trillion. I heard the number this morning. It's a very, very big number, and it's bigger than the amount that's owed by Americans on credit card debt. It's bigger than the amount that's owed on mortgage debt. It's the biggest consumer debt ingredient we've got in terms of its scale. I think the bill for forgiveness that he announced, which was this $10,000 ceiling generally, right, and the $20,000 on Pell Grants, and relating to people who have an income individually of less than $125 or $250, at least for the non-Pell Grant forgiveness. And the nominal bill for that is like $500 billion for that forgiveness. And it hits, obviously, a big portion of the total outstanding student debt. Now, there is this problem, and that is that a fair percentage of people who had that debt weren't paying it.
Right.
And it wasn't because of forgiveness they were going to let it. So let's say that 20% of that debt was not going to get repaid, or 25%. That means the actual loss to the American revenue scene is less than $500. It's $400 or $350 billion, but still a very big number. And of course, there's the equity issue. I'm sure you're going to get there with respect to the people who did pay off their loans, both in the past and currently, who are saying, well, wait a minute, you're forgiving people who haven't paid off their loans yet, but I did pay off mine. What happens for me? And I suppose the government could send them a check to reimburse them for the amount they paid back, but that isn't part of the proposal. So there is going to be some political backlash on this equity issue, and I'm sure Republicans will seize on that.
But Sandy, if
but incidentally, the amount of student debt that's been outstanding, the amount that's outstanding now is almost all of the student debt that was ever outstanding, because the rate at which student debt was being incurred by students has increased like an avalanche over the last 25 years. So that very much of the student debt that's currently outstanding in total, or that was ever incurred, has been incurred in the last 15 years.
But Sandy, we keep piling more and more and more every year. You're piling more and more on that mountain.
Well, that's right. Student debt is a reflection of the fact that education isn't free in this country like it is in the other developed countries. Student debt is a reflection of a problem the same way the lack of health care has become a problem as the nature of health care provision in this country changed from being group health care that was provided by employers. And as employers dropped that benefit and more people found themselves without health care, we now have an experience in this country of more and more people having a substantial student debt because the amount of public education that is readily available to them and affordable is not enough.
But isn't it nonsensical to know? I mean, I kind of blew my mind that student debt outweighs the debt for homes and home ownership, and what was the other one you said?
Consumer debt. Well, not together.
I know, but both of them.
Yeah.
That student debt, and you every year you're piling more and more. And then I guess what I would say to you, Sandy, you said many people aren't paying it anyway. Well, the penalty for not paying it is not having credit and not being able to
sure.
and to live inside of the society, right?
Oh, yeah.
So then that says that somewhere along the line you got to fix that.
Well, and that's why I'm surprised that America can't seem to look at the glaring problems they have, and all they come up with is a Band-Aid. You know, the Obama Affordable Care Act was really a Band-Aid as compared to providing Medicare for all, which would really solve the problem in a way. It might not be the way Europe has solved the problem, but it would solve the problem materially. Giving forgiveness for past debts doesn't solve the problem of the ongoing problem of school education being too expensive for everyone to afford. And of course, the people that it's most important we educate so they are upwardly mobile
can't afford
are the people who are starting at the lowest rung who can't afford it. So it's like a screwball notion. You know what we're really doing is we're putting a chicken in every pot. Politically, we're solving a problem for all these people, and sociologically, we're solving a bit of a problem for these people with outstanding debt, but we aren't solving the problem going forward.
Sandy, if I owe $125,000 of student debt, mm-hmm. and you waive $10,000 of it,
yeah,
I mean, come on, you know, it's not going to change and allow me to participate in the society where I can really benefit my family.
Yeah, and I'm trying to I saw a number, and I won't be able to remember it, but I think if you took student debt and said everyone who has $40,000 or less of student debt, if you total that all up, it comprises a very, very substantial percentage of the $1.7 trillion. So this example of people with $120,000, while we all know some people who have that kind of debt, that isn't where all of this debt has been incurred and is outstanding. So that's at least a different issue. But I think the real issue ongoing is we're not doing anything about it going forward, and we're leaving everyone else sort of marooned in their current situation.
So as we speak, children and parents are moving their children into dorms, right?
Yeah.
And we know at the end of that, it's going to be the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, still the same thing if nothing changes. Well, nothing's going to change. Why can't we get, Sandy, why can't we get the politicians, both Democrats and Republicans, to change? I know the lobbyists for education.
Well,
right?
And also status quo. I mean, we do have a huge infrastructure that's built up the way it is built up for education with all these private institutions and the tuition. They're all tuition driven, not endowment driven, basically, and with the costs that they have, and without evolving into virtual learning in a way that might be much cheaper for them to carry out. We've got an infrastructure that would have to be essentially toppled and recreated if we were going to move to something different, or we'd have to have the state willing to buy up all these institutions, you know, and turn them into public institutions and then fund them.
So, Sandy, it sounds like you're saying it's too tough to look at.
Well,
too tough to deal with. It's complicated.
Well, it's very.
I know,
it is very complicated. And however, if we don't deal with it, we're going to have this other problem. So I do believe that one thing that is happening out there, and maybe it will solve the problem, is many private schools are failing. And to the extent that student loans would be restricted in access, then more of them would fail. The unfortunate part of that is the people who need those loans then might not go to school, right? So that would be a problem. Although maybe what would happen is the ranks of all of the public universities would swell, and the headcount there would go up. Right now, the Wisconsin public university system has a shrinking headcount. So maybe if everyone was channeled into the public schools, we could more directly deal with the question of how we fund them.
So there are too many choices. And the society can't, the society can't itself, and the people can't make those facilities, sustain those facilities. Is it safe to say that?
Well, yeah, the amount of facilities we have and the cost they have is probably unsustainable if at the current cost level without a fair amount of attention being paid to it by a revenue stream that would come from the government. And instead of it being loans, which is essentially the government kicking the can forward, we're just kicking the can down the road by putting debt onto people which we should have understood would be unsustainable for them or would have an extremely destructive sociological impact, making it hard for them to buy homes, making it hard for them to generate credit, making it hard for them to have families. It's pushed childhood, for people who are planning their families and not having accidental children, it has pushed the age for parenthood well out into the future. It's probably going to push that the notion of lots of school debt would push the level of procreation of children in this country below the replacement rate, which incidentally we look at China and these other countries and shake our head and say they don't even have replacement rate birth rates in their country. Well, you know what? If we don't have immigration, we don't currently have a replacement rate. We're just at replacement rate in the United States, and this trend of student debt is going to push us well below
replacement rate. So, Sandy, how about this? And this goes back to, again, where you always say we don't plan. How about us saying, okay, instead of sending all of these young people to traditional colleges, you know, the trades and people who graduate from the trades or become journeymen have zero debt.
Mm-hmm.
And those jobs, the last time I checked, are safe as any future.
Well, one of the proposals was that community colleges and trade schools would be made free. That was a proposal in the past, and they're almost that now. It would seem to me it would be pretty easy to at least funnel people in the direction of trades that are in short supply, nursing,
yes,
and other trades, professions and trades.
And they pay well enough that many of these children who are in these universities and graduating from these traditional universities now, mm-hmm, won't make the money that these people we're talking about are making.
Well, we've used, the government has used that kind of market-based provision of funding into universities in the past. For instance, at the time of Sputnik, when Russia seemed to have a lead on us in science, we began to channel money into universities and into aid to students for studying science.
Right.
To try and develop the scientists necessary to put us in the moon race. And we could easily do that today. We could look at the requirement, the professional requirements in the American economy, and we could start facilitating students, the cost of education in those areas, to channel people at least in the direction where they would be better employed and without debt.
So is it, Sandy, that we've got families who don't want their children basically, you know, to go into those kinds of fields, which the last time I checked will never be replaced by technology, which are a place to be and safe a career. They'll never be outsourced. You're not going to outsource electricians, steam fitters, carpenters. You know, those jobs are going to be here forever.
Yeah.
And I know some guys who are in them and who are doing quite well, Sandy, can live anywhere in the suburbs they want to live and do all those things and make a lot of money. But when will our society look at that and say, hey, you and I are talking about it.
Well, that's
but what about the people who would sit down, Sandy, and try to figure this out?
Well, one of the benefits of the marketplace is that it does promote that kind of change. So people tend to look at problems as they exist today and the trajectory that brought them to that place, and they think that'll never change. And what you're saying will undoubtedly happen because it is true that student debt and the view that people would have to incur a lot of that has discouraged a lot of young people from going to school. People are making much more independent decisions about going to school. They're taking gap years. They're trying to figure out what they really want to do before they start investing themselves and their own money in school. So I think the marketplace is beginning to make those choices already, and that's a hopeful sign. But I think that America ought to look at this education debt problem and say, you know, these other countries that organize themselves differently, you know, some of them, we ought to look at some of that stuff instead of just sticking our nose into people's business where we think it isn't like it should be. Maybe we should look at where it's like and see what we should be.
Sandy, we got to go to a break. 844-967-2789. We'll be right back. As always, you can join us at 844-967-2789, 844-967-2789, Texas, that same number. You know, Sandy, the list just goes on and on and on about issues inside of our country that are really issues that, if not addressed, will cause us, you know, pain down the road. We can't just keep kicking these things down the road, but we keep doing it. We just keep kicking it, and then there are more and more things that happen.
Yeah, I think the more complicated and difficult the solution is to get away from the status quo. You know, we've got infrastructure in this country built up every year based on what is. So if you want to change it from what it is to something that it isn't to something new, it gets more and more difficult and more complicated, which is the sorry thing about why we set off on the path we did with respect to health care instead of the way other countries addressed it, and why we set off on the pathway we have with respect to education instead of the way other countries have addressed
it. But Sandy, all of these things are unsustainable.
Yes.
Well, that's all of them.
Well, that's the worrisome thing about the American situation. We've got this great potential. We've so far taken that potential a long way, but we've done it on a path which might be unsustainable. It's a bit like the foreign policy we were talking about before and some of the problems associated with it. You know, we can talk about it on Monday, but one of the things I wanted to talk about was the deglobalization of the world and returning back to sort of fragmented countries and the isolation that would exist then. It has some number of impacts, but if I was someone who owned a lot of assets, whether it be stock or real estate or whatever, I'd be very worried about this, because what is true and what they're at these most recent Federal Reserve Bank meetings that have been held most recently in Jackson Hole, what's clear is that the deglobalized world will be a world of higher interest rates. There'll be labor will be less fearful of competition worldwide and will be able to get higher wages. People who make goods will have less international competition that is supported by low wages, and they will raise wages higher because the general cost of operations, for instance, in the United States is quite a bit higher than the cost of operations in the globalized economy. Who will pay the price for that? Well, the American consumer, and the consumer will bear the cost of the inflation that will go on each year in that new, more enclosed environment. Inflation kills the value of stocks, and inflation kills the value of real estate. And so a great deal of the wealth in our country, the one that we worry about that less than 1% of our country controls, but that less than 1% has a great deal of influence over our public policies. If I were those people, I'd be very worried about the policy trajectory we're on, because when it takes interest rates higher, it's going to have a critically bad effect on the value of assets, and suddenly their fat will be in the fire too.
Well, you know, Sandy, the other side of that is the unrest that will occur inside of the nation because of that. I mean, you can't believe that the American people and the future with which far too many of them face, Sandy, that people are going to just continue to plug along and not be able to get any traction in this nation. They're going to push back. at some point in time. And you know, we come in and people may say, you talk about all these negative things. They're not negative things. They're the truth of what is happening.
Well, my point is that the conservatives and liberals alike ought to step back and look at the trajectory of what's going on here. And we could definitely get some unified ideas and notions about what we ought to be doing to improve our trajectory. Because it's our trajectory that's on the wrong track. And it's not on the wrong track in the direction of government spending too much money. It's on the wrong track with respect to how we've organized ourselves socially and what our social values are and how we're exercising those values.
Well, you know, Sandy, you can't help but anytime talking about the government spending the money, and it's where the government is spending the money, and we don't mind spending it in certain places.
Right. I mean, if we really want to be dominant, that's why I keep bringing up the military issues and the extent to which we're sticking our nose where it doesn't belong, because it's very, very expensive for us to carry out that process of thinking we have to be a dominant military power. We have to have a navy that's multiples the size of China's navy. We have to, you know, we have to have all these capabilities. We're currently spending over $800 billion a year, and what we're talking about now is to spend a multiple of that, some multiple of that, in order to sustain the status. Well, it's already costing us our capability to provide health care for all and to provide child daycare and these things that would be real investments in the future and would change the trajectory of our country in a way that would benefit those who have assets as well as those who don't, and it would avoid this need, this deglobalization, which we can, for a while, say, oh, it's going to be good for us in the way of jobs and what have you. But I assure you that deglobalization in the long run will have serious negative implications.
So, Sandy, look at the disasters that are happening in our cities, the flooding, all of those, the fires, all of those things that are going to continue. And our nation is not in a position to fully, not where we are now, to help those states and cities overcome.
Well, I mean
financially.
Yeah, because we get distracted by Taiwan.
Yes.
We decide that there are much bigger issues than the climate, which apparently is a huge issue, right? I mean, from the standpoint of whole parts of our country that are on fire.
underwater. Yeah. I just for the life of me, and it's increasing every year, and we see it's increasing every year, the droughts, all of those things, and yet we don't have the resources, they say, to address those things.
Well, we don't have the attention span or the focus either. So, because our attention span and focus is so easily diverted to flyovers in Taiwan and congressmen going to Taiwan and women being, you know, who apparently have large gonads. Is that a better word?
You just woke up Connor.
I've been awake this entire time.
I'm joking, man. When he used that term.
I mean, he said gonads, man. Like,
yeah. I think it's time to go. Let's hurry up and leave.
I thought that's all you said. Go. Time to go. I misunderstood. Gonads. Yeah.
Yeah. You got to go. Sandy, it's been great as always. We got to run. Thank everybody who made the show go this week. We'll be back on Monday. Thank you, Connor. Really appreciate it. See you later.